ethnic group membership. Jews, Muslims. Other groups are targeted because their non-mainstream sexuality draws attention to itself. In many societies, gays, lesbians, and transgender people are found disgusting because their bodily and sexual nature stands out, compels fascination. They seem more bodily somehow. Campaigns against equal rights for gays in the U.S. used images of anal intercourse and the alleged mixing of feces and blood to encourage the public to shrink from social contact with gay people, and gay men especially, in housing and employment. Still other groups are found disgusting because they straightforwardly remind the dominant group of their own weakness, their own future. Thus, the former untouchables in the Indian caste hierarchy were those who disposed of feces and corpses and who swept the floors. By avoiding bodily contact with them, people somehow fantasized that they avoided contact with the dirt in themselves, despite the fact that every day they themselves excreted the wastes the lower castes were carrying, and despite the fact that they saw humans dying in all social groups. Thus, too, in every society, people with severe mental and physical disabilities have been shunned as revolting, as if avoiding those instances of disability made people invulnerable to disabilities of their own. A special revulsion often greets the aging body, since that is the one group that everyone knows they will end up in sooner or later, unless they die prematurely. Keeping one's distance from wrinkled and halting bodies makes people feel better, as if stigmatization were a veritable elixir of life. Disgust toward women's bodies, menstrual fluids, loose flesh, combines with fear and desire in a unique way, so let's postpone that topic. If it is crazy and doomed to think that we can really avoid contact with animality, it is not so crazy to think that we can avoid contact with members of those symbolically freighted subgroups. Shakespeare's England simply expelled the Jews, so there simply were no Jews in Britain between 1290 and 1656. It was a brilliant stroke on the part of Shakespeare and his peers to imagine the disgusting in the form of a group that was real, that could be historically chronicled and vividly imagined, but that simply was not present in Britain at all. In our own time, the Nazi attempt to exterminate all the Jews of Europe was seriously undertaken, and to a horrible extent, successful. People with disabilities and aging people have also been targeted for extermination, but much more often they have simply been pushed to the margins, removed from the public square. Many cities used to have ugly laws forbidding people with disabilities or upsetting appearances from appearing in public space. Gays and lesbians were forced to live closeted lives, presenting in public only those aspects of themselves that fit in with the norms of the dominant group. In a wide range of cases, then, projective disgust makes people hide or retreat. In other cases, the disgust group is found useful by the dominant group, so they don't want to get rid of its presence completely. Then elaborate rituals develop to police interactions and prevent contamination. The Indian caste hierarchy, American treatment of African Americans, and male treatment of women all belong to this type. They are seen all the time doing their useful work, but arrangements prevent contamination. And people more or less come to believe that by avoiding X and Y and Z, they really do avoid sweat and feces and semen and snot. If an African American doesn't swim in a public pool, that somehow means that the pool is clean. No feces or sweat or urine there. Rationalizers said that these groups carried STDs or other contagious diseases and many probably really did believe this. What about moralized disgust? It's a familiar phenomenon that people feel disgust at things that they also think immoral. In some of these cases, the aversion has two components that we can at least try to separate. Thus, many people think homosexual sex immoral without feeling disgust. And many feel that gay sex is yucky without subscribing to a particular moral argument. Some people feel disgust for the bodies of African Americans and also subscribe to arguments holding that African Americans tend to be criminals. But again, the two elements are often found apart from one another. More puzzling are cases where it looks as if the disgust itself directly targets the immorality. We can be disgusted at the corruption of politicians, at horrible crimes, or at racism and sexism themselves. This phenomenon has long puzzled researchers, and it has puzzled me. I've treated it at length in other work. So let me summarize. In some of these cases, people are just using words loosely. When they say, "These politicians disgust me," they are really expressing protest or anger, and their emotion probably isn't disgust. In some cases, it really is disgust, but the ideation, more closely inspected, focuses on typical disgust ideas. The criminal's bloody acts are vividly imagined. The politicians are imagined as like cockroaches or rats. In other cases, insofar as the emotion is disgust and not anger, there is still at its core a general idea of purity and dirt, and the person is expressing a wish to be free of the contamination of those dirty people, to get to a purer place. In my view, such cases do not show that disgust is socially constructive, since what the disgusted person wants to do is to flee, rather than to solve the problem. I sometimes imagine moving to Finland, a country I know pretty well but not too well, and therefore imagine as a land of blue, clear lakes and social democratic purity. Nor is disgust reliable for legal purposes. Thus, jurors are typically disgusted by the mention of blood and gore. But murders may be especially awful and not involve such sensory characteristics. Consider the murder of a guard during a bank robbery. So I resist the claim of some scholars that in such cases disgust is politically productive and reliable. But I grant that some of these cases don't involve the wish to subordinate. Disgust and what we fear. Fear lies at the heart of primary disgust, keeping us away from what both alarms and, often, threatens us. Because primary disgust does not sufficiently distance us from what we dread, fear engineers projective disgust as a further protective mechanism, threatening equality and mutual respect. But because fear ramifies widely, creating many different varieties of disgust stigma, we need to understand the endless plasticity of these social formations in order to zero in on the ones most pertinent to our own political moment. Although we could focus on many types of exclusion, I want to focus on two that seem especially acute today. Bodily disgust toward African Americans and toward gays, lesbians, and transgender people. Complicated, hate-filled reactions to the presence and success of women in our society involve a toxic brew of disgust, anger/blame, and envy, so I'll discuss them separately. Let me mention briefly what this chapter does not include. The disgust that fuels discrimination on grounds of disability and age is an important social evil, but I have just focused attention on it in my co-authored book, Aging Thoughtfully, so I shall leave that to one side. In any case, it does not seem to be an issue involved in our current debates, Age discrimination, I'm afraid, is robustly universal and crosses party lines. Muslims are targeted for hate crimes, and in India, the propaganda whipping up that animosity does use a rhetoric of disgust, speaking of Muslim bodies as smelly because they allegedly eat beef, hypersexual and hyperfertile, by contrast to the allegedly pure and sexually self-controlled body of the Hindu. Narendra Modi campaigned in his home state of Gujarat on the slogan, "We are two and we have two." Each Hindu couple has two children. "They are five," because each Muslim man is imagined as having four wives, even though polygamy is no more common among Muslims than among Hindus. "And they have 25. Just a nice number to make the rhyme work. Using obscene propaganda about Muslim women's bodies, Modi and his allied groups whipped up murderous rage against Muslims, leading to the Gujarat genocide of 2002, in which around 2,000 innocent Muslim civilians were murdered. But in the U.S., the hatred of Muslims is focused on Muslims as objects of fear, without disgust. Let's then test the analysis by focusing on my two test cases. They help us see how the damage of disgust can be inhibited through education and law. In our recent Jim Crow era, which has not entirely disappeared, African American bodies were regarded with disgust as sources of contamination. Drinking fountains, lunch counters, swimming pools, hotel beds, none of these could be shared. People otherwise intelligent and civilized believed that black bodies carried a powerful taint. As a child of a racist father from the Deep South, though living in the North, I was told that African Americans smelled different, that they would spread disease by using the same toilet facilities, that if they used a drinking glass, you had better not drink from that glass again, even after washing it. Although this disgust was based in fantasy, it took on bodily reality. Thus, during Reconstruction, one hears of people who, having moved from the South to the North, and then being seated at a mixed-race table, literally vomited. I've used the past tense optimistically. But the white supremacist marchers in Charlottesville in August 2017 show us that these ugly fantasies live on. But what was this anxiety all about? In part, this disgust evinces the anxiety about animality and embodiment that is common to all forms of disgust stigma. But each projective formation has its own specific traits, and we can understand ours more clearly through two comparisons: to the disgust involved in the Indian caste hierarchy, and to anti-Semitic disgust. The Indian attitude toward untouchables shared, and sadly still shares all too often, since 30% of Hindu households still observe untouchability. Many themes with our own racial disgust. These include a refusal to share drinking water and food, swimming pools, hotel beds, and a more general avoidance of bodily contact. B.R. Ambedkar, the great architect of the Indian Constitution and one of the top legal minds of the modern era, grew up, he tells us, as a Dalit, formerly called untouchable, child, who was rich and well-fed and clothed because his father worked for the British Army, which was racist in many respects, but did not observe the caste hierarchy. At school, he could not drink water from the common tap, in a region of India where the temperature often reaches 115 degrees, or sit on the mats on which other children sat. When he traveled with his sisters, wearing expensive clothes, neat and starched, and carrying lots of cash, he could find no hotel that would take them. All of this sounds just like the Jim Crow South, where even well-to-do and successful black baseball players could not stay at white hotels well into the mid-1950s. But there are differences. Here's a weird difference that just goes to show how irrational the whole disgust system is. African Americans often cooked and served food in white households. A Dalit, however, could never even enter the kitchen in an upper caste Hindu household. And the touching of food was a central locus of stigma. There's a further weirdness, however. In the Jim Crow South, often the plates off which black people had eaten were broken so that they could not be used again. Baseball great Hank Aaron describes this common practice in his autobiography, noting, "If dogs had eaten off those plates, they'd have washed them." So the U.S. South had convoluted and bizarre practices regarding food. Blacks could cook and serve food for whites, but they were thought to contaminate the plates they themselves used. And here's a further large difference between Indian caste disgust and U.S. racism. Dalit men were regarded as pathetic, weak, and low. They were not seen as fearful sexual predators who desired sex with upper caste women. Avoidance of sexual contact went along with the whole system. But rape by Dalit men was not a fear central to upper caste ideation. We could say that the Dalit man was seen as rather like a cockroach, dirty, low, disgusting, but not really powerful or strong. It was otherwise with the African-American male. An honest look at our heated debates about school integration in the 1950s shows that the fear of sexual contact between black men and white women was at the very heart of the reluctance to integrate schools. In a recent important article, my colleague Justin Driver, a leading scholar of constitutional law, has assembled all the evidence for this picture in a relentless manner, showing that even an apparently benign leader like Dwight Eisenhower was phobic on this topic. Speaking confidentially to Chief Justice Earl Warren, then deciding Brown v. Board of Education, Eisenhower implored Warren to see that segregationist white Southerners are not bad people. All they are concerned about is to see that their sweet little girls are not required to sit in school alongside some big black bucks. The idea of the black man as a dangerous animal lying in wait ran through all of our fraught debates. And I would argue that these same images are potent now, though in many cases they have gone underground, fueling what psychologists call implicit bias. Bias that shows up on empirical tests, even though the biased person is not aware of having it. So disgust and fear combine in a way that is sui generis, and quite different from the way disgust was shaped in India. Baseball great Don Newcomb tells the story of one all-white hotel that allowed the black ball players to stay in 1954 so long as they promised not to use the swimming pool in proximity to scantily clad white women, and they were given rooms that faced away from the pool. 70 years later, these ideas haven't disappeared. In Charlottesville, Virginia, during the August 2017 white supremacist march, one young female counter-protester was told by a marcher, female, "I hope you get raped by a nigger." Let's think now about Jews. Jews, like African Americans, were widely regarded in both Europe and the U.S. as hyper-bodily and hyper-animal, as more smelly, more sexual than their Gentile counterparts. The Jewish nose was an obsessive topic of comment and was clearly seen as a kind of genital organ. The trope that Jews smoke big long cigars, which my father repeated to me on many occasions, reinforced the picture of Jews as sensuous and indulgent. American antisemitism has similar themes. Today, these two are rarely voiced, although the alt-right defiantly does so. However, there were two large differences between anti-Semitic disgust and the racial disgust of that same era. First, Jews were seen as highly intelligent animals, dangerous because of their guile, whereas African American men were imagined as brute beasts. So what bigots feared was subtly different. Being taken over by a clever conspiracy of bankers in the former case, rape and murder in the latter. This shaped the parameters of the prejudice. Thus, my father objected strenuously to my appearing in public, in a mixed-race group, apparently reasoning that people who saw such a group would suspect sexual intimacy. What else, he evidently imagined people thinking, would a black man be doing there? But he had no analogous fear of my socializing with Jews, so long as I was not going to marry one, as I later did. Probably because he knew that people could infer all kinds of intellectual and professional purposes from such a gathering. Furthermore, although Jews were seen as hypersexual, they were not typically seen as rapists or predators or as physically aggressive. Indeed, more often Jewish skill in sports was denigrated and Jews were represented as weak. So here again we see that each discussed formation has its own nuances and its own history. The fact of common threads running through all forms is significant, but it doesn't relieve us of the responsibility of dissecting our own moment and our own pathologies. These comparisons teach us that where Jews are concerned, insofar as we still sadly grapple with anti-Semitism in our time, what we need to watch out for are fantasies of Jewish guile, Jewish corruption, Jewish plots, as well as Jewish vulgarity and crudeness. Where African Americans are concerned, we need to watch out for the tendency to portray black men as predators, criminals, brutes, and violent by nature. And we also need to watch out for the idea that black children can't learn or won't learn, or even worse, that they will inevitably prefer crime to education. Hank Aaron notes with some bitterness that reporters typically represented his reserved and shy demeanor as that of a shuffling colored boy. They knew the story they were going to write before they met him. Given the strong psychological evidence that bias remains buried in most Americans' minds, even when we believe in all good faith that we are not racist, we must work extra hard in the opposite direction. Thus, when decisions are made about school budgets, about school busing, and about how to improve failing inner-city schools, whites, Asian Americans, and Latinos urgently need to work against their own likely implicit bias, and of course, some blacks may share these biases, proceeding on the assumption that all children have similar capacities for learning and achievement in decent circumstances, and making extra efforts to give such circumstances to black children, emphasizing throughout the education process their future opportunities and possibilities. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel has suggested recently that Chicago might adopt, as part of high school graduation requirements, a plan for each student's future, worked out in consultation with teachers and guidance counselors. Children need to know what employment opportunities they have. They need to know that community colleges are free of charge, and that attending one can open up many future possibilities. Obviously, privileged kids already have this information, but requiring a plan is a way of making sure that teachers and guidance counselors don't let implicit bias lead them to shortchange African Americans on the assumption that they don't want to achieve or to work. In criminal justice, the history of bias carries a strong warning. Knowing that both police and civilians may harbor implicit pictures of black men as predators, and it is hardly ruled out that black police officers may also have implicit biases, we ought to favor police training that instructs officers about the studies that show high levels of implicit bias, and we should urge them to test themselves for such biases. Training should also place a large emphasis on procedural justice, as leading criminal justice scholars Tom Tyler and Tracy Mears of Yale Law School have been arguing. Firm procedural rules help disable bias and stigma. Hank Aaron says that he dealt with the race bias of umpires, which he had long observed, by hitting more home runs than anyone else, thus not putting my fate in the hands of the umpire. But less extraordinary mortals can't always hit a home run. They have to rely on the white man's justice, as Aaron puts it. We'd better work to make that justice a lot more truly just. Law has already done a lot to inhibit stigma, desegregating schools, rendering racial discrimination in housing and employment illegal, and integrating public facilities. There is more work to be done on the integration front, since many neighborhoods and many public schools are de facto segregated. In her important book, The Imperative of Integration, philosopher Elizabeth Anderson argues cogently that only integration of schools and housing will really put an end to stigma. My analysis supports her. Disgust feeds on fantasies of the other, and sharing a common daily life is the best way to explode these fantasies. Now let's turn to gays, lesbians, and transgender people. Here again, there is a thread of bodily disgust running throughout the political propaganda against equal rights, which bears a strong similarity to other instances of projective disgust. I was present in a Denver courtroom in 1994 during the bench trial of the case that later became the landmark Supreme Court case, Romer v. Evans, on the day when Will Perkins, chief proponent of a referendum known as Amendment 2 that had denied gays and lesbians the right to seek protection from local anti-discrimination ordinances, testified. He admitted that in support of the referendum, he had circulated pamphlets that said that gay men eat feces and drink raw blood. 15 years later, writing about constitutional law and same-sex rights, I studied the pamphlet literature circulated in the early 21st century by opponents of gay civil rights and found that little had changed. Here's a typical example from a pamphlet by Paul Cameron, a leading anti-gay activist, entitled Medical Consequences of What Homosexuals Do. The typical sexual practices of homosexuals are a medical horror story. Imagine exchanging saliva, feces, semen, and or blood with dozens of different men each year. Imagine drinking urine, ingesting feces, and experiencing rectal trauma on a regular basis. Often these encounters occur while the participants are drunk, high, and or in an orgy setting. Further, many of them occur in extremely unsanitary places. Bathrooms, dirty peep shows. Or, because homosexuals travel so frequently, in other parts of the world. Every year, a quarter or more of homosexuals visit another country. Fresh American germs get taken to Europe, Africa, and Asia. And fresh pathogens from these continents come here. Foreign homosexuals regularly visit the U.S. and participate in this biological swap meet. To the canonical references to bodily fluids and dirty surroundings, Cameron adds the idea of foreign travel as source of contamination, surely an idea that resonates with many Americans. Okay, let's now step back and analyze this specific case of projective disgust. First of all, it is not aimed at achieving total separation of facilities, for the obvious reason that this would be impossible to police, given the closet. Second, the disgust formation has little to do with a general aversion to same-sex conduct as such, since women are standardly omitted from disgust propaganda, and sex between two women is a titillating staple of pornography directed at straight men. In Britain, sex between two women was never illegal. In the U.S. it often was. But it's fair to say that hate literature gave this option short shrift. The propaganda is also, obviously, not directed at preventing gay men from having sex with and marrying women. Indeed, that would be a quote-unquote good outcome for the anti-gay movement. The propaganda depicts gay men as rapacious and sex-crazed, but not as threatening to our sweet little girls. Indeed, the bigot wishes they would take a greater interest in those girls, and sexual orientation conversion therapy, though discredited, continues to attract support. However, gay men are indeed seen as potential predators toward straight men, as America's agonized debates about shared showers in the military showed. The very gaze of a gay man was seen as deeply threatening. One sometimes hears of another anxiety, that by getting married to one another, gay people would somehow sully or taint the marriages of the heterosexuals who live next door. Such an idea, however, cannot be understood without thinking in terms of irrational ideas of stigma and contamination. It can't really be a consistent moral thought, since the people who express it are content with laws permitting criminals and even child abusers to marry. What's really going on here? People may, of course, have personal moral objections to homosexual contact or to same-sex marriages, but this would naturally lead them to avoid such contact and such marriages, to counsel their children against them, and to join religious groups that share their beliefs. That's how people typically deal with their moral objections to other types of immorality, such as financial corruption or failure to meet financial obligations. Such moral objections do not explain the anxiety and disgust with which sexual orientation and gender identity have been discussed. Many Jews and Christians do not approve of interreligious marriages, and they counsel their children against them. But there's no disgust there, unless there is antecedent anti-Semitic or racial disgust. So why does the idea of same-sex marriage arouse disgust? It seems that the projective disgust targeting gay men in particular, and LGBT people more generally, is partly a general disgust anxiety about bodily fluids and sexuality. Gay men, because their sex is non-procreative, seem somehow more sexual than other people, most of whose sexual acts are also, of course, non-procreative. And they come to emblematize the fears many Americans have about the uncontrollable, animal nature of bodily desire. In part, too, this disgust is an anxiety about the new, the uncannily unconventional. In times of upheaval and moral and cultural change, people need to draw sharp lines and to repudiate anything that diverges from previously accepted patterns. Today, at a time when gays and lesbians are living productive lives in every region of our country, dispelling disgust by their sheer presence and their constructive engagement in communities of many kinds, a new object of disgust anxiety has surged into prominence. Trans people who want to use the bathroom of their chosen gender. It's too soon to have good studies of how projective disgust figures in these phenomena, but it is surely significant that the bathroom is their focal point. And the fact that the anxieties make no sense is a good sign that they come from some other and deeper place. Why do I say that they don't make sense? Because a person who looks like a female would not upset people by entering a women's room, where the other women would have no way at all of seeing their genital anatomy. She would look just like them, as is her intention and commitment. It would be a person who looks exactly like a male who might make women anxious in the women's room. And yet it is exactly this situation that anti-trans activists want to require by law. A person who has transitioned from female to male would be forced to use the women's room. This case then resembles the anti-gay animus already discussed. It involves a fear of change, a desire to enforce traditional boundaries, and a bodily shrinking from vulnerable people that is either an instance of projective disgust or is closely akin to it. It is utterly different from a religious or even moral objection. All my three cases involve disgust, but not the simple type of disgust with which one tries to avoid slugs or roaches. Disgust becomes dangerous in these cases, prompting opposition to equal civil rights, or even crimes of bias, because of an underlying fear of bodies, of animality, and of change itself, that feeds the disgust. Why disgust now? Either hate crimes have really increased or more of them are being reported. In either case, there's new awareness of this social problem. In part, this greater concern may be occasioned by signals from the newly influential alt-right, which has a permissive attitude toward bias and indeed doesn't even see it as such. Demeaning stereotypes that were long carefully hidden parade openly in 2017 on the streets of Charlottesville. In part, there may be a subtly different explanation. In studying violence against lesbians and gay men, Gary David Comstock found that the cause for this choice of target was not a deep-seated hatred, but simply the belief, often on the part of drunken youths seeking to act out and create trouble, that the police didn't care about these people and thus one could assail them with impunity. So the influence of the alt-right might be operating in a slightly different way, signaling to potential aggressors a relaxing of public protections for vulnerable groups. They are people against whom one may be able to aggress with impunity. President Trump's failure to condemn bias groups unequivocally is thus extremely dangerous. Our understanding of implicit bias, peer pressure, and cascades suggests that hatred is labile. Most people who engage in hate marches and even hate crimes do not have a lifelong commitment to such actions. They can go either way and can be radicalized by signs of permission and approval. In any case, we have plenty of evidence now that bias crimes are a large social problem and that our proclaimed post-racial era has not yet arrived. However, my account of disgust, linking it to fear of the stickiness and vulnerability of embodiment, suggests an additional diagnosis for an upsurge of bias. When people feel very insecure, they lash out to blame and scapegoat the vulnerable. We can now add that their tendency to project disgust outward is likely to rise to the extent that their own sense of bodily vulnerability and mortality rises. Disgust is always specific, combined with specific fear thoughts. But the insight that disgust is about fear and fueled by a constellation of specific fears makes it plausible that the need for a disgust group and the intensity of disgust stigma will rise, other things equal, in times of general insecurity. Being aware of this phenomenon should make us redouble our efforts to scrutinize our politics for hidden and not-so-hidden bias. What about positive efforts to counter disgust and stigma? Walt Whitman's proposal that we should celebrate our own bodies, and thence the likes of them in other men and women, is utopian. Does it suggest any strategy for democracy to follow? Clearly, the war against disgust must be fought, first of all, in the family, in the school, and in the upbringing of children more generally. School integration across all the problematic axes of difference goes a long way to assist people in seeing different bodies as non-monstrous and fully human. But only if schools and teachers monitor bullying and cultivate an atmosphere of inclusiveness and respect. I have already suggested that where race is concerned, Real integration of housing and schools is an urgent necessity. The fact that gay, lesbian, and transgender children can turn up in any family means that the task of integration is less complicated. Basically, it requires encouraging young people to come out to family and classmates, and the fact that so many have already done so is surely a big part of the sweeping and highly age-related social change we have seen on topics such as same-sex marriage and bathrooms. But children are not innocent of bias by the time they are in school, and efforts to stamp out bullying and stigmatization of children by one another are crucial parts of any successful integration program. Today's internet and social media present many dangers, since people can access hate groups very easily and avoid contact with more positive messages. Fortunately, television and film offer better possibilities. Comedy is a particularly valuable anti-disgust genre because, ever since Aristophanes, comedy has pursued an agenda of reconciliation with the body. If you can laugh at the ridiculous things bodies do, it becomes that much harder to view the bodies of minorities with anxiety. Thus, people who thought they didn't know any gays or lesbians can become the virtual friends of Will, Grace, Karen, and Jack. Learning that gay men pursue different paths, that they can be loving friends to women, better often than straight men, and that they are not aiming at the disintegration of society. Even Jack, who pursues pleasure, loves his son. Or they can recognize, watching Modern Family, the truth that families are multiform, that same-sex couples care for children, that love, resilience, and humor are more important than the traditional or untraditional nature of their trappings. Race needs tragedies as well as comedies at this point in our social evolution, and most of the high-quality shows are not mendaciously neat, like The Cosby Show, but run the gamut between tragedy and comedy. The Wire, Orange is the New Black, and feature films such as the Oscar-winning Moonlight, which brings our two types of exclusion together. Hollywood has done far better with sexual orientation than with race up until now, but things are at least starting to change. It seems perverse to consider cutting federal funding for the arts and humanities when we understand their role in bringing people together across divisions often made worse by social media. Really, and this is the heart of the matter, such mass media can bring us together with ourselves. Chapter 5. Envy's Empire. So far, we've seen how primary fear interacts with two developmentally later emotions, anger and disgust. Fear often hijacks the sense of outrage and protest, turning it into a toxic desire for payback. And fear infuses disgust's aversion to mortality and embodiment, producing strategies that exclude and subordinate. Now we must add another emotion to the poisonous brew. Envy. Envy is at large in our nation. Envy has threatened democracies ever since they began to exist. Under absolute monarchy and especially under feudalism, people's possibilities were fixed, and they might easily believe that fate or divine justice had placed them where they were. But a society that eschews fixed orders and destinies in favor of mobility and competition opens the door wide to envy for the competitive achievements of others. If envy is sufficiently widespread, it can eventually threaten political stability, particularly when a society has committed itself to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all. Envy says that only some enjoy the good things of life. Enviers hate those people and want to destroy their happiness. We see envy on both the right and the left. On the right, A sense of stagnation, helplessness, and even despair propels many lower-middle-class people into envious denigration of Washington elites, of mainstream media, of successful minorities, of women taking their jobs. People wish ill to those by whom they feel eclipsed or displaced or neglected. On the left, many have-nots envy the power of bankers, of big business, and of political insiders who support those interests. Envy is not simply critique, which is always valuable, since it involves animus and destructive wishes. It wants to spoil the enjoyment of the haves. Let me say right away that I view envy as problematic, even when its cause is just. In many current cases, it's difficult to figure out where justice lies. There is surely merit in the grievances of working-class white people, just as there is merit in the demands of the left for greater economic justice. But it's one thing to say, here is a problem we need to solve, and you should join with us in figuring out a better way. It's quite another thing to wish ill to the dominant group, and to want to spoil their happiness. Envy's hostile desire, like, and closely related to, the retributive element in anger, is a bad thing for democracy, even when the envied don't have a right to all the good things they enjoy. Envy leads to a picture of social cooperation as a zero-sum game. For me to enjoy the good life, I have to make you unhappy. This type of thinking is similar to, and very likely rooted in, envy between siblings. The envious sibling doesn't just want love and attention. She wants to displace the other one from love and attention, just as for Aaron Burr, in Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, putting himself into the room where it happens requires evicting his rival. Even if the sibling's parents, or Burr's quasi-parent, George Washington, had been unfair in lavishing attention on the rival sibling, Hamilton, it is always unsavory to wish pain and failure to the other as a condition of one's own success. But this is a hard lesson to learn, since democracy, to some extent unlike family, is inherently competitive. Can it arrange to have competition without envy? Defining envy. What then is envy? As usual, philosophers typically ask about definitions, and this search for clarity proves useful, directing us to the root of this insidious political problem. People say different things in different times and places, but there's a common core of agreement. Envy is a painful emotion that focuses on the advantages of others, comparing one's own situation unfavorably to theirs. It involves a rival. This could be a group, and a good or goods the envier thinks very important. Enviers are pained because the rival has those good things and they do not. Typically, envy involves hostility toward the fortunate rival. The envier wants what the rival has and feels ill will toward the rival in consequence. Envy thus creates animosity and tension at the heart of society. And this hostility may ultimately prevent society from achieving some of its goals. Now we need to distinguish envy from three of its cousins. One cousin is emulation. Emulation also involves a focus on the advantages of others, and it also involves important matters. But people who emulate feel no ill will. They view those others as outstanding exemplars. They don't want to take anything away from those people. They just want to move closer themselves. What's the difference? Two related things, it seems. Emulators think that they can indeed move closer to the goal. For example, by following the advice of a beloved teacher, they can become more like that teacher. And second, very important, emulation focuses on achievements that are not entirely matters of zero-sum competition. The reason students think that they can move closer to their teacher is that they believe many people can have knowledge, and the teacher's knowledge does not threaten them but actually assists them. Or think about kindness. It would be weird to envy your friend because she is so kind. Just be that way. Work on yourself. When the quality is one that we think people can attain by effort, emulation is far more likely than envy. Envy is different. Its ill will typically comes from a feeling of impotence, which I'll later connect to primary fear. There's no obvious way of getting what the rival has, and enviers feel doomed to the inferiority that they experience. Often, furthermore, this sense of doom is linked to the fact that some things are not wide open to anyone who tries to get them. Being popular, being rich, winning an election. All these are examples of competitive zero-sum goods. Goods in short supply, where one person's possession threatens another person's chances. Another cousin of envy is jealousy. At first, the two might seem almost the same, but they are importantly different. Both envy and jealousy involve hostility toward a rival with regard to the possession or enjoyment of a valued good. Jealousy, however, is typically about fear of losing something one has, usually a relationship of personal love and attention. Whereas envy senses the absence of good, jealousy focuses on its valued but unstable presence. Because jealousy focuses on the self's most cherished relationships, it can often be satisfied, as when it becomes clear that the rival is no longer a competitor for the affections of the loved person, or was never a real competitor. Only pathological jealousy keeps inventing new and often imaginary rivals. And jealousy is not always pathological. Envy, by contrast, is rarely satisfied because the goods on which it typically focuses, status, wealth, fame, and other competitive goods, are unevenly distributed in all societies, and no person can really count on having more than others. When we're insecure, we feel that we may not get the things that we need in order to live well. But what is distinctive of envy is the fantasy that others have the good things and I do not. I am on the outside of a happy relationship, a happy job, a happy social life. Think of Othello and Iago. Othello was jealous, and pathologically so, obsessed with the fantasized disloyalty of Desdemona. Most spouses are not like this. But he did not have a general insecurity about status or success, or feel cut off from wonderful things that were just out of reach. Iago, by contrast, is not jealous of Othello. He doesn't crave Othello's love and attention. What he wants is to be Othello, to have the good things Othello has, fame, achievement, love. He sees that he doesn't have those things. So he wants to spoil the happiness of Othello, to render him loveless, low, miserable. Finally, perhaps the most difficult distinction of the three, envy is a cousin of the type of anger that is based on belief in a status injury. Envy does indeed focus on status. The rival has good things and I do not. Like anger, it is accompanied by hostile feelings toward the rival. The primary difference is that status anger requires a belief that some definite insult or affront has occurred. Envy, by contrast, feeds on the rival's happiness alone. The rival may have done nothing to insult the envier, and indeed may not even be aware of the envier's existence. This distinction is important but difficult to make in any particular case. Because enviers like to fantasize insult and to blame the happy, even when blame isn't justified. Even more subtly, they may blame the rival by blaming a social hierarchy in which the rival has a privileged place, whether or not that structure is in fact unfair or demeaning. Once again, critique is always legitimate, but envy is not simply critique. It is destructive hostility. Envy's roots in fear. I've said that envy is born of insecurity. Fear, then, is at its root. The fear of not having what one desperately needs to have. If we were complete, we would not need anything, and so we would not have envy. Or if, being incomplete, we were nonetheless confident in our ability to grab hold of what we need, then the fact that others have good things would not be an emotional problem. So we need to think about insecurity and helplessness to understand envy's power. To see why it's so important to link envy to fear, let's consider a powerful view of envy that does not make that connection. The view of Immanuel Kant. According to Kant, human life contains radical evil, a propensity to harm others that is not learned in culture, but is part of our human situation itself. However, the problem is not that the devil drives us or that we have an innate evil spirit. We are basically oriented toward goodness. The problem is that other people get in the way. Envy, addiction to power, avarice, and the malignant inclinations associated with these assail his nature, which on its own is undemanding, as soon as he is among human beings. Nor is it necessary to assume that these are sunk into evil and are examples that lead him astray. It suffices that they are there, that they surround him, and that they are human beings, and they will mutually corrupt each other's moral disposition and make one another evil. Kant's account rings true in some ways. Envy does seem to arise as soon as people are in groups or even families, but the story is obviously incomplete. Why does this happen? Why does the mere presence of other people lead to competitive and hostile behavior? And does envy always arise in group situations? Surely some situations make destructive envy far more likely than others. In his memorable discussion of envy in A Theory of Justice, John Rawls answers my second question. He suggests that there are three conditions under which outbreaks of socially destructive envy are especially likely. First, there is a psychological condition. People lack secure confidence in their own value and in their ability to do anything worthwhile. Second, there is a social condition. Many circumstances arise when this psychological condition is experienced as painful and humiliating, because the conditions of social life make the discrepancies that give rise to envy highly visible. Third, the envious see their position as offering them no constructive alternative to mere hostility. The only relief they can envisage is to inflict pain on others. This is an important analysis, offering us insight into our current predicament, as we'll see. Rawls, however, did not try to answer my first question, what is really at the bottom of the problem of envy. People can be loving and cooperative, so it can't be right to say that the mere existence of a plurality ushers envy onto the scene. The philosopher who got to the heart of the matter is, once again, Lucretius, who applied the general view of his mentor Epicurus to the problems of the Roman Republic, which was already a cauldron of destructive envy in his time, around 99 to 55 BCE, and which imploded shortly thereafter. Here's what Lucretius saw all around him. From a similar cause, from that very same fear, envy wastes them away. Look how this man, before their very eyes, has power. How everyone gazes at that one, as he gets some distinguished honor. While they themselves, they complain, are wallowing in darkness and filth. This marvelous poetic account captures, I think, the peculiar pain of envy. Envious people are obsessed with looking at the success of others. Seeing those, they compare their lot unfavorably to theirs. Envy does make you feel as if you are in the dark, and also dirty, tainted, wallowing. Seeing yourself that way does waste or gnaw you away inside. This combination of hopelessness and sharp torment makes envy one of the most excruciating of the emotions. Lucretius also tells us why